the Ukraine Peace Summit wraps up.
I'm confident that together we will ensure the result. The first and the second peace summits should unite our joint work on the details of peace.
So, what are the key takeaways?
The Western world and others saying, you know, here's what we need. And then you've got Putin and a number of allies in the global south saying what Putin's offering is good enough. You ought to take it.
And Israel announces a humanitarian pause.
It happens to be a bigger gesture than all the previous humanitarian pauses.
Today is Monday, June 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Miller. The vast majority of more than 90 countries attending a Swiss summit on peace for Ukraine supported its final declaration, but some countries that were in attendance did not put their name on the communique, and there was no clarity on whether future talks would involve Russia. Reuters' Alice Rizzo kicks things off for us today.
Initiated by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, the two-day summit at the Swiss Alpine resort of Burgenstock aimed to find a consensus on how to end the war in Ukraine.
I'm confident that together we will ensure the result. The first and the second peace summits should unite our joint work on the details of peace.
Many Western leaders voiced condemnation of Russia's invasion and rejected President Vladimir Putin's demands for parts of Ukraine as a condition for peace. However, some countries attended the summit did not put their name to the communique, including Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and India. There was no clarity on whether future talks would involve Russia. Swiss President Viola Amard.
A lasting solution must involve both parties. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the discussions over the past 2 days have shown that there are different points of view. All the more important is our understanding that the path towards peace in Ukraine must be pursued on the basis of international law and, in particular, the United Nations Charter.
Moscow, which was not invited, labeled the summit a waste of time. China was another notable absentee. The conference nevertheless underscored both the broad support Ukraine still enjoys from its allies, but also the challenges for any lasting ceasefire. A draft of the final declaration seen by Reuters refers to Russia's invasion as a war, a label Moscow rejects. It calls for Ukraine's control over the Zaporizhia nuclear plant and its Azov seaports to be restored and for Ukraine's territorial integrity to be respected. But in line with the conference's more modest stated aims, it omitted tougher issues on what a post-war settlement for Ukraine might look like and whether Ukraine could join the NATO alliance. The Kremlin did not rule out future talks with Kyiv, but said guarantees will be needed to ensure the credibility of any negotiations.
Alice Rizzo of Reuters News. So, what are the key takeaways and the challenges that remain following the summit? Well, to dive deeper into that, I spoke with Texas Christian University political science professor Ralph Carter for analysis.
Well, you have two things going on here. One is the Western world and others saying, you know, here's what we need. And then you've got Putin and a number of allies in the global south saying what Putin's offering is good enough. You ought to take it. And I don't think that's going to happen. And I think the fact that the Biden administration announced an executive agreement for a 10-year defense arrangement with Ukraine makes that more certain, at least for the lifetime of Biden's time in office. So I think basically there's just a whole lot of talking going on. There's no bargaining room in between these two positions that I can notice that makes any sense. So somebody's going to have to give in, and I don't see that happening real quick. But this does buy Putin something that he needs, which is the need to look reasonable to his friends in the global south, where the Russians have a bigger presence than a lot of Americans recognize. And to them, him saying, I'm simply trying to reclaim parts of my country taken away by Western imperialists is a message that resonates there.
Yeah, to that effect, I mean, before the conference began, you know, Putin put out his proposed peace plan where, you know, the four illegally annexed areas that Russia has now control over would remain Russia, that NATO aspirations by Ukraine would have to be off the table. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been very steadfast in his comments saying that no, all the territory integrity of Ukraine must be reestablished. And as you mentioned, those are two diametrically opposed, you know, positions. So, you know, while it may play better to the global south where Russia is advancing its influence there, there are calls for continued dialogue. How do you reach a point where you have a discussion if the two points are so far apart?
Well, diplomatically, what these things generally take is one side to start getting leverage. And I've just been reading about how the Kharkiv offensive by the Russians is stalling out and they're losing even more personnel there. If the Ukrainians can mount a counteroffensive and the Russians start losing territory, as they lose territory, then there may be more pressure on Putin to try to amend his demands, hoping that he can find something that Zelensky would agree to, short of Zelensky's total rejection of Russian presence on Ukrainian soil, and Putin could still call that a victory.
Yeah, you mentioned the Kharkiv kind of offensive by Russia stalling out, and the latest counteroffensive by Ukrainian forces didn't have the breakthroughs that some analysts were hoping for. But given that the Donbass, as well as Crimea, have been firmly in pro-Russian or Russian control since 2014, is there any likelihood that you see that either of those two areas could be that leverage gaining position for Zelensky? Or are we really talking about some of the Zaporizhia, the Kharkiv regions that were, you know, taken by Russia in the full-scale war that began back in 2022?
Well, if you had someone besides Zelensky in office in Kyiv, I think that there might be some sentiment to accept Russian control of Crimea and the smaller portions of Donetsk and Luhansk that they possessed prior to February 2022 and call that the best deal they could get. But with Zelensky taking such a firm stand that there will not even be direct negotiations with the Russians until every Russian troop is out of traditional Ukrainian soil, I just can't see it happening.
Ralph Carter is a political science professor at Texas Christian University. Ralph, as always, we thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. Officials say 14 Jordanians have been reported dead during the annual Muslim Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, some due to heat stroke, while 17 others have been reported missing. The death announcements come as Muslim pilgrims performed a symbolic stoning of the devil on Sunday. It's the riskiest part of the annual Hajj, as large numbers of people gather to perform the ritual, which also marks the first day of the Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice holiday. South Africa's MK Party will join an alliance of smaller opposition parties in parliament in a bid to challenge the African National Congress and Democratic Alliance-led coalition government. The United States cricket team has made more history, qualifying for the second round of its T20 World Cup debut after its last group game against Ireland was washed out in Florida. Defending champions England also advanced, as did unbeaten India. The elimination round, or the Super Eights, begin on Thursday. We now continue with our ongoing 2024 U.S. presidential election coverage. Former President Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, says that people are voting illegally in U.S. elections, including immigrants. One California city is moving to impose voter ID rules that happen to violate state voting laws. Jenny Dulot has the story.
picturesque Huntington Beach is known as Surf City, USA, but its political notoriety in this election year is over a local ordinance requiring photo ID before in-person voting. Mayor Gracie van der Mark says it reflects citizens' concerns about election integrity.
You can't even go see your doctor without an ID, but the most important thing in our country is our election system. Because every single thing we do is determined by politicians and who we put in office. Our lives are dictated by who we put in office, and then they start legislating. So we want to make sure that the integrity of our elections is protected.
Non-citizen voting is a political issue in this presidential campaign. In Arizona, last week, Donald Trump accused Joe Biden of allowing immigrants to cross the Mexican border to illegally vote for him in November.
Somebody's going to explain to us why they would want this to happen. I guess it's probably votes.
There is no evidence that non-citizens vote in significant numbers in the U.S. elections. Most U.S. voters confirm identifying information when they check in to vote, but they're not required to show identification. Huntington Beach Council member Dan Kalmick opposes the voter ID measure and says it reflects his city's more conservative shift.
Well, voter ID is for in-person voting, but only 15% of the city voted in person in the last election. What problem are we trying to solve? We're trying to solve for 1,000 people that are going to vote in person. Again, it just proves that it's political. There's not actually a problem that we're trying to solve here.
California has its own voting laws, and the state is suing Huntington Beach over a measure Attorney General Rob Bonta says adversely impacts low-income voters, voters of color, young or elderly voters, and people with disabilities. Charlie Zabla is an immigrant who owns a local Mediterranean restaurant. He says the voter ID measure does not discriminate.
Oh, just because you're poor doesn't mean you don't have a driver license or you cannot obtain a driver license.
Oakview Comunidad is a nonprofit group working to narrow the social, cultural, health, and economic gap in Huntington Beach. Co-founder Oscar Rodriguez says the law will suppress voter turnout in lower-income neighborhoods.
You're confusing people. And so when people are already having low voter turnout, it may be because of childcare, having multiple jobs, because they don't trust the system. And then you're adding an additional layer of voter ID, then that kind of confuses people and it may turn away people to come out to the polls and vote.
City leaders say they're ready to fight the state over voter IDs for local elections. Those legal challenges will take the case beyond this November's vote, when the state voting laws will remain in effect here. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Huntington Beach, California.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Israeli military said that it's pausing fighting during daytime hours along a route in southern Gaza to free up a backlog of humanitarian aid deliveries for desperate Palestinians. Earlier, I caught up with Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv to get the details.
It's already started today. It is in force between 8 in the morning until 7 p.m. They say every day until further notice. It coincides with the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha, when families get together and have meals and festive get-togethers. It happens to be a bigger gesture than all the previous humanitarian pauses, both in the number of hours that are involved and in the length of the roads that are being protected from any kind of Israeli airstrikes. The Prime Minister Netanyahu stated that he was unaware of the move, even though it's being conducted by a unit of the Israeli army. But it's another example of his attempts to walk a tightrope between the demands of the U.S. and other European allies and between the far-right members of his government coalition who reject any kind of increase in humanitarian aid because they claim that it is seized and used by Hamas.
Ricky, as you mentioned, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was unaware that this was going to take place. And the reporting out of Israel is saying that the prime minister called the humanitarian pause unacceptable. But going back to the humanitarian aspect of this, you mentioned that this is bigger than what has been offered in the past. Can you explain more about, you know, the logistics of this pause and where it's taking place? And also, as I understand it, the fighting that's taking place in Rafah itself isn't going to pause.
The pause is being conducted on the main north-south artery, the Salah ad-Din artery, that goes from the south, which includes Rafah, up to the north. But besides that artery that aid will be able to travel by, in Rafah in the south and in the north, fighting is continuing.
And one last thing, you know, it was one of the things that the United States did was build this floating pier in the Mediterranean. And there was a pause before. And then most recently, the pier had to be detached once more because of concerns over safety, weather and so forth. What's the latest on aid getting to those in need in Gaza through this pier? And what does this latest detachment mean?
The pier, unfortunately, seems to be kind of a lemon in that it has been out of operation for more time than it has been in operation. Right now, they have detached it and they're towing it to the Ashdod port in Israel until the turbulence in the sea is finished. And then they plan to bring it back to the beach in Gaza. But there are other considerations. Some of the UN and other humanitarian aid organizations that have been transporting the aid from the pier into sites within Gaza have complained that there is the impression, whether it's true or not, that in last weekend's Israeli army rescue of four hostages, the area around the pier was used to evacuate the hostages and a wounded soldier. And this is contrary to the promises by the U.S. that it would be a completely neutral, nonpartisan territory just for the delivery of aid.
Ricky Rosen, reporting from Tel Aviv, Israel. Now, catching up on some weekend news, Haitian leaders have ousted Franz Elbe. Now, he's the beleaguered director of Haiti's National Police, following months of criticism that he wasn't doing enough to protect officers under assault from gangs. Now, the effective date is not clear, but the decision will likely go into force after a decree from the prime minister and the presidential transition council.
Continuiamo aggiungere notizie dolorose.
Pope Francis has called on national and international authorities to take action to stop the bloodshed in the eastern portion of the Democratic Republic of the Congo following a week in which dozens were killed in the North Kivu province. Eastern Congo has struggled with armed violence for decades as more than 120 groups fight for power, land, and valuable mineral resources. Some groups have been accused of mass killings. And finally, a little fintech or financial technology news for the day. A lack of laws governing digital currencies has slowed their expansion in the United States. Cryptocurrency investors tell VOA's Deanna Mitchell they are encouraged that the U.S. House of Representatives is considering a new legal framework for electronic money.
Digital currencies were on their way up until cyber attacks in recent years caused many investors to lose billions of dollars. Now, cryptocurrency experts say digital currency is ready for a rebound, thanks in part to congressional action to regulate digital asset markets. Arkansas Representative French Hill.
We hear a lot about the lack of legal clarity for the treatment of digital assets, which was the impetus for this legislation.
North Carolina Representative Patrick McHenry says the Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act, or FIT 21, will ensure the United States remains a global leader in technological innovation and adoption. North Carolina Representative Patrick McHenry says the Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act, or FIT 21, will ensure the United States remains a global leader in technological innovation and adoption.
At its core, FIT 21 applies time-tested consumer protections to ensure the 20% of Americans who engage in the digital asset ecosystem can do so safely, and so more Americans can engage as well.
Matthew Graham is managing partner of the emerging technologies venture capital firm Rise Labs. At a recent crypto conference in Texas, he said the United States is trailing the world in digital currency and should not presume that the standard for most electronic money will continue to be U.S. dollars or USD.
Do you really view USD hegemony as an overwhelming and foreign national interest? Then that's a very strong reason to double down on incentivizing crypto, because if there's anything that's good for the future of USD hegemony, it's an alternative for future financial asset class that is overwhelmingly USD.
In this U.S. presidential campaign, there are digital currencies named for but unaffiliated with President Joe Biden and the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump. Third-party candidate Robert Kennedy Jr. was at the Texas Crypto Conference, where supporter and American Crypto Academy CEO Jahan Jamali launched the digital coin Bobby.
What we've seen over the last year or so are what's called meme coins sort of translate out of crypto into movement type of coins, especially now that it's a political election year here in the United States.
If senators do not take up the House digital currency legislation in this election year, it may be up to the next president to shape cryptocurrency's future in the United States. Dina Mitchell, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
And that does it for today's program. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 12th, the United Nations Security Council examined the human rights situation in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, despite objections from representatives of Russia and China, who protested that the UN Human Rights Council, not the UN Security Council, is the appropriate venue for such discussions. U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, responded that in North Korea, human rights abuses and violations are inextricably linked with the regime's threats to international peace and security.
Nowhere in this nexus is it more salient than in the DPRK, where substantial evidence and documentation have directly linked the regime's mistreatment of citizens with its investment in unlawful WMD and ballistic missile programs.
Indeed, according to the UN, the DPRK invests most of its efforts into developing its military power, ignoring the state's responsibility to allow its people to live full lives. To finance this endeavor, the regime largely resorts to diversion of resources, including food and forced labor. According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, nearly half of North Korea's population is undernourished. The regime engages in modern-day slavery, both inside the country and abroad. The state confiscates up to 90% of the wages of those it sends to work abroad. The DPRK's repression and totalitarianism, proliferation, and gamesmanship makes each and every one of us less safe. And, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, it has a profound human cost.
Today, the DPRK continues to deny individuals their rights to freedom of expression, thought, conscience, and religion or belief. It continues to execute, torture, arrest, and physically abuse individuals engaged in any quote-unquote unauthorized activity, including those related to religious beliefs and practices. There are new laws and regulations enforcing repressive ideological control, further limiting freedom of expression and cutting off access to all information outside the country.
It should be easy for every single one of us to condemn this unjust and inhumane activity. And yet, there are members of this council who not only fail to speak out against this repression, but also actively embolden it, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. It is our responsibility as members of this council, as human beings, to speak out against a regime that chooses weapons over the welfare of its own people. That is how we create a better future for the people of the DPRK and a safer future for us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.